This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, and today's host for Trumpet Hour, Joel Hilliker, is out today, and he asked me to fill in for him. Thank you for listening. We have a great program for you today. Lots of important news to discuss, so let's get right to it. I have with me here in the studio some of our News Bureau staff, our analyst covering Asia issues, Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Richard Palmer via Skype from our News Bureau in the UK. Good to have you with us, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Brent Noctegal, who follows the Middle East region.
It's good to be here.
And Anthony Chibrarwe, who is covering the United States and the English-speaking world. Good to have you, Anthony.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Our top story and our cover story in the Trumpet Weekly this week is titled Germany, Migrants, and Angela Merkel's Big Lie. It's written by Brad McDonald, who works out of our news bureau over there in the UK, along with Richard. Unfortunately, he was unable to join us today. But I think this topic is really fitting for today's show because this was one of the most important stories of 2015, if not probably the most important story of the year in terms of, you know, potential impact on the world, in terms of how it is affecting Europe, and in particular, in terms of how Christian Europe is responding to the 1.5 million Muslim refugees that have entered last year. And just watching that reaction is very revealing. It's revealing because of the historical overtones of Europe that it's bringing out. I think it's revealing because of how we know that Europe will eventually respond based on Bible prophecy. So in this article, Brad McDonald reports on a recent trip of his to Germany and across several countries in Europe, and he discusses the attitudes of Europeans towards this Muslim immigration crisis. Their thoughts, what they are saying, people on the ground are saying as he encounters them. And as Brad brings out, there appears to be this growing belief among Germans that they're being intentionally misled by their leaders, even deliberately lied to by Angela Merkel herself and her pro-migrant allies in the government and in the media. And this is upsetting a lot of people. You know, in Germany and in many places in Europe, there's a very stark divide that's growing between those who are very much for and who love this ideal that Europe should be welcoming and open to all migrants and those who are experiencing the firsthand challenges of absorbing millions of migrants. And there's this clash growing. There's a stark divide. You know, on one hand, you have the mayor of Kassel, and he told native Germans that if they didn't want to become Muslim migrants, that they were free to leave Germany. You can go. If you don't like this, if you don't like accepting these migrants, then get out. Go live somewhere else. Now, basically, he's telling native Germans that their concerns and their rights are less important than the migrants who are coming here. So that's the far fringe on the one side. And then on the other side, in the article, Brad talks about, you know, a policewoman who says that many of these Muslim migrants that she encounters have no respect for the police. They have no respect for the rule of law. And they have no respect in particular, you know, to female officers. You know, she talks a lot about how these Muslim immigrants, they're even very, very young Muslim migrants, they're just very bold and they refuse to listen or respect the police. And then you have the rise of those protest groups on the right-hand side as well. And it's a second group that really seems to be having this, you know, it's growing in anger. Recently, I think there was a report that came out that basically said that, I think Brad actually mentions this in his article, that Angela Merkel's government knew all along that the number of refugees would be way higher than what they were telling the people, way higher than what they were telling the media. And as it turns out, you know, there's this report released, and it suggests that they knew, Merkel's government knew that the number of migrants would be twice as many as what they were actually telling the media. So there's a sense growing among Germans that their government has completely and utterly betrayed them. Now, Richard, I know that you're over there on the ground in Europe. You're staying on top of European news. What's the feel that you get over there. You know, how dangerous is this situation?
Well, in this article, Mr. McDonald was able to draw on his travels and his conversations with Germans. And I don't really travel as much as Mr. McDonald, so I don't have just that same personal connection with Germany and what some people are saying. But it is something that you're seeing, not as much, as Mr. McDonald brings out in this article, not as much as it needs to be, but this is something you are seeing stories about cover-ups and what you're seeing in the press more and more. So, for example, just since Mr. McDonald wrote this article and since it was published on our website, Bild, this is the largest newspaper in Germany, they had an article saying that the police were covering up the extent of migrant crime in Germany. And so they were saying that migrants were being used as cheap drug traffickers and drug dealers and in petty theft. And they said that there was they were having a meeting in Frankfurt with various different officials. Migrant crime, they said, was a hot topic there. And this was a problem that a lot of these officials were trying to deal with. But then it said that the main officials dealing with migrant crime had been ordered not to talk about it because it was a sensitive subject, and they've been told not that it could be offensive, and they were told not to alarm the general public. So we are seeing now more and more stories start to come out of exactly what Mr. McDonald talks about in this article. And just about every week, there seems like there's another story about some of the downsides of immigration coming out.
Now, Richard, this isn't a problem that's just endemic to Germany. This is an issue that's gone even beyond Germany's borders. Isn't that right?
Right. This is another article we have in the Trumpet Weekly that I think really shows us what is coming soon to Germany. Sweden has been Europe's most welcoming country of refugees. If you talk about countries that are inviting refugees up out in, Germany and Sweden, the two that are up there. But Sweden this year, just towards the end of this year, had a complete reverse. The deputy prime minister, we talked about briefly on this show, announced it, and she was in tears. And so this is a quote from this article that we had from the Washington Post on this subject. After taking in more asylum seekers per capita than any other nation in Europe, Sweden's welcome mat now lies in tatters. Overwhelmed by the human tide of 2015, the center-left government is deploying extraordinary new border controls and slashing benefits in an unmistakable signal to refugees contemplating the long trek to Sweden in the next year. Stay out. And it says that Sweden is already on course to enact policies that would have been unfathomable just months ago.
Well, that's interesting that you bring up, some of this language that we're hearing out of Europe, things that are happening that were unfathomable, as you said. It just reminds me a little bit. I mean, there's people making comparisons to the days in the lead up to World War II. At this point, do you think that's fair? Or is that just, is that a little overblown at this point?
Well, what I think is most dramatic about this Sweden article is you don't even need to go there, I don't think, to attitudes and what people's attitudes are to immigrants. Just because of the practicalities of having this number of migrants come through presents so many challenges. So, Sweden, they had all these immigrants come through. They ended up sleeping on the streets in the middle of a Scandinavian winter. Just because they cannot physically cope with that many people. And I think that's the same kind of thing you're going to get in Germany right now, is that they're just it's more about laws of physics than necessarily a racist backlash, is that it's just you can't physically accommodate that many people.
So what's the next phase then, Richard?
Yeah, exactly. Then like Mr. McDonald points out, as people start to see they've been deceived by the government, that's when you start getting these repeat of the history in the 1930s. So you already were seeing some of that repeated history just with the economic crash before the migrants came in. You have the same surge in parties that nobody's ever heard of before. And so it is absolute. So that trend is there and it has been building. But this will just add new impetus to that once these practical problems start coming up and then people start blaming the current governments for these practical problems.
Right. So no easy solution is basically what you're telling us.
No, I mean, if you can't, on the one hand, you can't let a million people in and house them all. And on the other hand, how do you keep them out without completely changing this kind of liberal, multicultural character of modern Europe?
And ending up with something that resembles, like you said, the 1930s.
Exactly, because when Europe's not been modern and multicultural, it's been at the other extreme.
Right. Very dangerous. Richard, thank you very much for your thoughts on that, for the update on conditions in Europe. At this point, Richard, I'd like to go ahead and encourage our listeners to visit thetrumpet.com to look at this article that we're discussing, or to go ahead and visit thetrumpet.com and subscribe to the Trumpet Weekly News Digest. It's this week's cover story, and it's titled Germany, Migrants, and Angela Merkel's Big Lie. For those of you who are just joining us, we were just discussing the migrant crisis in Europe and how some experts are now comparing it to a ticking time bomb. They're comparing it to the 1930s and the lead up to World War II. Today, you're listening to us via 101.3 on FM dial or via live stream at kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Since we're talking about Europe, let's go ahead and stay with that theme. There's a lot of news out of Europe this week. Richard, if you don't mind, go ahead and bring us up to speed on some of the more important developments out of Europe this week.
Well, as everyone who's lived over here is familiar with, everything kind of shuts down in between Christmas and New Year's. But despite that break, there's still been a lot of news, a lot of it related to those kind of celebrations. So this reflects a lot of the big news reflects this growing fear of terrorism within Europe that we talked about on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour program. There were two arrested on suspicion of planning a terrorist attack in Brussels at the start of this week, and they're accused of planning an attack for New Year's Eve. A Muslim couple were found guilty of plotting a terrorist attack in the UK. Both Brussels and Paris cancelled their New Year's firework displays. They were afraid that these large crowds of people could become targets for terrorists. And police in Munich also warned of a serious, imminent threat of a terrorist attack on New Year's Eve, and they asked people to stay away from the city's main train station. So there were no terrorist attacks in the end over New Year's Eve, but it just shows this increased fear of Islamic terrorism in Europe. And then the other bit of news I'll quickly touch on ties into what we were talking about earlier, immigration. This was the subject of Ms. Merkel's New Year's Day message to Germans and thanking them for their welcoming of immigrants. And that, as we've talked about before, is a policy that she's now become very closely associated with. And then also it emerged that Germany's federal states will be putting 17 billion euros towards the refugee crisis. That's according to Die Welt. But they noted that the actual costs will be even higher because that 17 million prediction comes from this earlier government prediction that 800,000 refugees would be entering Germany.
Which, as we know now, is wrong. There was 1.5.
So that figure is going to be much higher. So that's just, again, the practical expense of coping with all this immigration.
Right. Thanks, Richard. So the big story this week out of Europe.
Well, as we promised on last week's Trumpet Hour Week in Review program, we'll be talking about Pope Francis and his award of the Charlemagne Prize. Now, some of our listeners might be a little familiar with the Charlemagne Prize. It's something that has cropped up on our website every now and again. It is a prize awarded for the person who's made the biggest contribution to European unity. So big people in the past, like big Europeans founding fathers have won it. Angela Merkel's won it in the past. I think Tony Blair has. I think Bill Clinton won it for his what he did in the Balkans. And now they've decided that the person who's really done the most to promote European unity is the Pope. And this is a really, really interesting, I think, because if you were to completely ignore Europe's history and the history of the European Union and start looking at the European Union as it is today, with none of that context in mind, you probably wouldn't come away thinking, well, that the Catholic Church has much to do with it or much to do with European unity or anything like that. A lot of the modern leaders are quite secular. They're kind of from the liberal left. And they've even hounded some Catholic. There was an occasion where they kind of hounded a Catholic EU commissioner from office a while ago. But this award just really reminds us of the long Catholic roots of this project, but then also is just a very interesting demonstration of how, when things are looking bad for Europe, again, they're looking back to the Catholic Church for hope. So in awarding this prize, the prize committee, they talked about how Europe had gone through 7 years of weakness, crisis, and setbacks, and they said that it had caused a dramatic loss of confidence. And we have an article coming soon on our website just talking about how there are quite a few signs at the moment that people are looking at and saying, well, the European project is just doomed to collapse. So it really is a bleak situation in some of those terms, whether Europe and the European Union, the euro, these things can survive. They're coming under real pressure. And they wrote that in these times in which many citizens of Europe seek orientation, they wrote that the Pope sends a message of love and encouragement. So now things are starting to look desperate. That is when the Pope really shines as a unifier.
So we see Europe, it's desperate. There's all these forces tearing it apart. And here we're seeing what sounds like what you're telling us is that the leadership of Europe is looking towards the Roman Catholic Church to be a unifying force to counteract all those things that are tearing the continent apart.
Well, the prize committee doesn't actually have any leadership role within Europe. It's mainly, I think it's like officials from Aachen, etc., and some bigwigs, but it's not a official European body. But I think it is indicative of what people are thinking in Europe, and it also gives the Pope's profile just a really big boost in Europe. You know, all of Europe's top leaders will be there at the prize-giving ceremony, which will be held in Rome instead of Charlemagne's capital of Aachen, as kind of a special event with this award. So I think it shows that there are people thinking that way, and it will help other people think in that direction as well.
What does it say about the Pope's diplomatic force these days?
Right, exactly. The awards criteria is for people who work towards integration, and this is a quote, and who are able to exert a political influence. So, yeah, it is a testament to the political power of the Pope. And the other thing we're bringing in this article is something we talked about on this exact program. I think actually last time you were guest hosting, we talked about this report from the Konrad Adenauer Foundation talking about how the Vatican is a superpower. And they placed a lot of emphasis on the Catholic Church's history as a unifier and as a mediator and as a power that can bring different nations together. And this Konrad Adenauer Foundation, they are the official think tank of Angela Merkel's party. So this isn't just the Charlemagne Prize Committee thinking along these lines. It is the thought that is becoming increasingly common within Europe now.
Very interesting, Richard, especially this how Europe, talking about the Charlemagne Prize, Europe just loves to invoke the heritage of Charlemagne. The leadership does, because Charlemagne was known for uniting the continent of Europe. But maybe, Richard, just before I let you go, and maybe before we talk a little bit about the prophecy behind this, you could give listeners a brief rundown of what the heritage of Charlemagne really is about.
Right. Well, Charlemagne, like you said, is the one that so many European leaders will hearken back to again and again. But the Catholic Church was absolutely central to his vision of unifying Europe and the way he unified Europe. The most famous incident of Charlemagne's life would be I think it was on Christmas Day, where he was crowned by the Pope, the Holy Roman Empire. And there was this fantastic's not really the right word, but a very powerful symbiotic relationship between the political power and this religious power. The religious power needed protection. It had a lot of wealth. And so Charlemagne did that. He protected the Catholic Church, protected the Pope. And then in return, the Catholic Church provided the kind of political and sociological legitimacy for Charlemagne's reign. And got people to look to him and elevated his status above all the other kings and made him kind of the emperor. And then he used priests and he used Catholic officials essentially to administer his government. It was essentially a theocracy in that the Catholic institutions of the religion were absolutely inseparable from the government institutions. And at the same time, it was an incredibly violent empire. It was an empire that won territory by conquest. It was an empire that killed those that had a different faith. And again, that's another way the two parties there work together.
Right. That's the other aspect of the heritage of Charlemagne that the leadership in Europe doesn't talk about today. But it does remind me a lot about some of those statements that Herbert Armstrong made, you know, decades and decades ago, you know, 50 years ago, back in the 1960s, he was talking about how the Pope would step in as, you know, the supreme unifying authority, the one institution that would be able to unify Europe. And he called, you know, he prophesied based on, you know, what the Bible says, that Europe would look to Rome to help it unite. And from what you're telling me today, it sure sounds like that is happening.
It's starting to happen, yes. That quote, or quote from him we've gotten here from the United States and Britain in Prophecy, he wrote, "So far, the common market has been unable to bring about full political union, and we see the same situation today." And he wrote, "This will be made possible by the good offices of the Vatican, who alone can be the symbol of unity to which they can look." And so, as you said, it's exactly as Mr. Armstrong wrote. They've been trying all these different ways to bring about unity, and they have increased their unity, but they've not been able to have that full political union, and only the Catholic Church can be that symbol and with that just deep heritage that all of Europe has with the Catholic Church, only they can bring about that unity.
And we're seeing it today. Richard, thank you very much for bringing us that report. Thank you for joining us today. All these articles that we've been talking about and that we will talk about today are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. It's a very informative, high-quality report that we produce each week. It contains the most significant stories and the best commentary from the best sources that we can find. I'd encourage you to subscribe to this free, absolutely free weekly news report. Just go ahead and log on to thetrumpet.com and become a subscriber. Coming up next, news from the Middle East, Asia, and Anglo-America. And then later, our lightning round of important headlines from our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Trumpet Hour with your host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker today. You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from the past week. We have been talking about Muslim immigration, Angela Merkel lying about the true extent of the crisis. We've been discussing this week's announcement that Pope Francis was awarded the Charlemagne Prize for his efforts at unifying the continent and how that was actually prophesied in the Bible. Let's now go ahead and turn to the Middle East and to Brent Noctegal. Brent, what's been happening in the Middle East?
Well, just some headlines to start off here. Early on Tuesday this week, we had Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and they got together and they reached an agreement setting up a strategic cooperation council in order to boost ties. The announcement was made after a meeting between King Salman of Saudi Arabia and the Turkish President Erdogan. They were meeting in the capital of Saudi Arabia. And this group is set to increase ties, military ties, security ties, economic ties, they said, trade, everything. They're going to come together. And it's been reported in Russia as an anti-Russian alliance because of how Turkey and Russia are going back and forth right now. So it looks like the Saudis and the Turks are getting a little bit closer. We've been reporting on that for a long time. Also, Ramadi was recaptured, by the Iraqi army this week, booting out the Islamic State. Now, Callum Wood has an article probably coming in next week that's really good that will put this so-called victory of the Iraqi government against the Islamic State in its true context. So please read that. And then on Saturday this past week, it was reported early, during the week, but the event took place on Saturday, we had five Iranian Revolutionary Guard vessels approaching the USS Harry Truman in the Straits of Hormuz. One of them fired multiple unguided missiles within 1,500 yards of the U.S. aircraft carrier as it was passing through those straits. This is the third provocation in 14 months by the Iranians along the Persian Gulf there.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Lots going on this week. What do you say is the top story from the Middle East?
Well, the top story does include Iran and its relations with the U.S. So just following on from that last headline there of what took place on Saturday, on Wednesday, there was a really interesting story that was ran through the press. The Wall Street Journal ran it. Reuters ran it as well. And it announced that the U.S. President Barack Obama and his administration were preparing new sanctions on international companies and individuals over Iran's ballistic missile program. Now, this was such a shock that here we are, and we've seen what's taken place over the past year where the U.S. has folded to Iran in many instances because of they wanted the nuclear deal. And here this week, they're going to announce we've got new sanctions coming over their ballistic missile program. Now, the ballistic missile program, that isn't connected to the nuclear negotiations. This is all about former resolutions by the UN Security Council against their program. And they've broken those resolutions, so the United States felt that it was okay to go ahead and put sanctions on them in defiance of those resolutions, not the nuke deal. Now, Iran saw that, of course, as a violation of the nuke deal because there shouldn't be, according to the Iranians and the JCPOA nuclear deal, that there shouldn't be increased sanctions on Iran during this time once the deal goes into effect related to their nuclear program because they've done their side of they've fulfilled their side of the bargain. But, you know, they say that's connected to the nuke deal, but the U.S. says it isn't these sanctions.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about these ICBMs, these intercontinental ballistic missiles, the purpose of them, why the U.S. is concerned about these.
Right. Now, there's Dory Gold. He's the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who he leads the foreign ministry in Israel, and he's been watching these Iran's nuclear program since early 2000s, writing books about it. And he informs Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. And he's written about how the sole purpose of these ballistic missiles is to hold nuclear warheads. And that's obvious to everyone around the world. Of course, Iran decries that and denies that and says that's not the case. They're just to hold normal warheads. But, you know, why would you, as you say, why would you why would you create intercontinental missiles that travel thousands and thousands of miles and then put on a conventional weapon on it? It's not going to do that much damage.
Right. Why shoot a missile around the world to blow up a house?
Right, exactly. So the rest of the world does agree, apart from Iran, that these are for their nuclear warheads. Now, I'd just like to fill in some more backstory to what happened after this announcement. It's really interesting of what happened after the United States said, hey, we're going to slap them down with new sanctions. Something interesting happened on Wednesday that changed. So the White House on Wednesday morning, they sent a notification to Congress at 10:30 saying that the Treasury Department is going to announce these new sanctions. Then the White House sent a second email to the congressional offices 45 minutes later saying that the sanctions announcement had been delayed for a few hours. And then finally that evening at 10 p.m., officials said the sanctions had been delayed and they didn't specify when they are going to be brought into effect. So while the United States came out and they announced themselves that they're going to release these sanctions, by the end of the day, they had decided they're not going to do it.
So what happened?
Who knows what happened? We're not exactly sure what happened. We can see what the response from the Iranians was. They decided that, well, one, they came out and said that day that it was absolutely ridiculous. We did not fire on that warship, the USS, I forget what it was, earlier on, the USS Harry Truman in the Strait of Hormuz. No, we didn't do that. We didn't even have a military exercise going on. Lie number one. And then they said, well, if the United States is going to do this, we're going to actually increase our intercontinental ballistic missile program in response to the fact that they said that sanctions were going to be announced. And by the end of the day, those sanctions were delayed further.
Right. We'll probably never hear about those sanctions again.
Right, right. So what in the world happened? I mean, well, what happened was that there was such kickback from the Iranians that these sanctions were going to, they believe they were going to hurt the nuclear agreement. Iran probably said, well, we're ready to walk away from the nuclear agreement. And America says, okay, well, we're not going to actually put those sanctions on you.
This isn't something we should be that surprised about, really.
I'm still surprised about it, actually. The fact that, you know, you wouldn't have this line of thinking. If you're the American government, why would you say, you sent the letter to Congress saying that you were going to put sanctions on them for doing this, and then at the end of the day, you say that you're not going to do it. This is like you've created this whole situation yourselves. So I'm surprised that they actually released the fact that they were going to do it. If they hadn't thought in their heads, you know, what is going to be the kickback from Iran, and are we willing to deal with that kickback?
But hasn't that just characterized the whole nuclear negotiations? You know, like red line after red line, or demand after demand, backing off, caving
right.
in, giving in.
Yeah, that's what we even talked about on Wednesday's program, how the United States have given in to Iran quite a lot through these nuclear negotiations, a lot. And even if there's probably a bunch of stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about and we're looking at it a little bit superficially, but even if that is so and there are other reasons for the United States doing what it did, what does it look like to the world? That's what's important. What it looks like to the world is United States was going to put sanctions on Iran. Iran says, no, you don't, or else we're going to do this, this, and this. United States says, okay, we won't put sanctions on you. That's what it looks like happened to the rest of the world.
Right. Now, allies watch America backing down again. Brent, thank you very much for the report. We are going to transition now. We'll head away from the Middle East and we'll head towards news from Asia. And for that, we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah, tell us what we need to know about Asia this week.
Well, first of all, China wants the Japanese island of Okinawa. Okinawa is key to the American-Japanese alliance, and it's the heart of America's military presence there in Japan. But if Beijing gets its way, the U.S. military bases will soon be off Okinawa, and Japan, too, will be off the island. So China has long said that it is the rightful owner of Okinawa with a really brazen political campaign, but now this week, China has ramped up all of those claims to another level by making incursions into the waters near Okinawa. It's a really bold move. And then there's what I believe is a related story here from Japan this week. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, he made a landmark apology to South Korean comfort women. These are women who were coerced into Japanese military brothels before and during World War II, a terrible situation there. But Japan has finally apologized for it to a degree that the South Koreans view as sufficient. And then Japan also agreed to pay millions of dollars in reparations to these women. So it's a hugely symbolic move that will likely mend the relationship between Tokyo and Seoul that has been really strained for so long. And I believe it's because these nations fear China. They fear stuff like what we saw there in the waters off of Okinawa, and they feel that they can no longer count on America for protection. So now they are burying their old grievances, and they're working toward the creation of historic new alliances.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Big, big things happening in Asia, but I know you have another story you want to bring to us today.
Yeah. I think probably the biggest story from Asia this week was a report in The Atlantic showing that Russia and China are having increasing levels of success in waging gray zone conflicts. So this is an article titled Brave New World, and it basically says that these gray zone type conflicts may well be the way power is exercised in the foreseeable future. These are not conventional conflicts where the enemy is, you know, the soldier pointing the barrel of his tank or his gun at you. in these gray zone conflicts, nothing is easy to see. It's all very murky, very shadowy. They're often called hybrid or nonlinear or ambiguous types of conflict. And basically, they mix psychological operations with lots of media propaganda. They throw in a lot of economic and cyber warfare. And then there's a little bit of conventional military operation also sprinkled in there. But there's never anything nearly as straightforward as a declaration of war. Never anything like that. And this Atlantic piece shows just how successful both Russia and China have been with this during 2015, the year that just ended. With Russia, its ongoing campaign in Ukraine has been really successful largely because of Russian propaganda that cultivates unrest inside of Ukraine. A lot of segments of Ukrainian society and even the West in the U.S. and whatnot are just confused by all of these waves of disinformation and propaganda. And meanwhile, Russian proxy forces and covert troops launch just enough military offensives to ensure that the Ukrainian government looks weak. And so the point is not really to occupy territory so much as it is to destabilize Ukraine psychologically and to advance this narrative that just says Ukraine has become kind of a failed state. And then you've got something very similar happening with China's ongoing conquest of the South China Sea. Beijing is using three different non-physical tactics to great effect. And these are legal warfare, psychological warfare, and media warfare. And with these three gray tactics, China's having a lot of success at just subverting the global media, undermining international institutions like the UN, and even changing borders, all without firing a shot.
So this type of warfare, this is something that we haven't really seen to this extent in recent years. Is this something that America is engaging in as well? Or is this something that this report is saying, others are saying that this is something that America is really being left behind in?
Well, I believe that all nations use these types of psychological warfare and whatnot to a degree. But this piece says that while in the past, disinformation and whatnot were sort of the handmaiden to action, now the informational element, at least with Russia and China, has become just as important, if not more important, than the physical dimension. And the United States and NATO especially are left behind by this. They're not prepared to deal with the level of this sort of disinformation and psychological warfare that is being used.
This seems like this is a really big development, especially living in an age of nuclear weapons, where confronting people head on can lead to, you know, very big explosions, right? This seems like this is a new type of warfare, at least in a lead up to something bigger.
Yeah, that's right. And NATO, this Atlantic piece was written by Peter Pomerantsev, and he actually spoke with a senior NATO official, or a few of them, just asking, are you guys ready for this sort of thing? Are you able to counter it? And the answer that he said he got was that in terms of conventional warfare, you know, tanks, even nuclear missiles, and things like that, NATO's on top of it. But anything regarding these sorts of gray conflicts, they are just now beginning to try to develop ways to counter all of this.
Right. You've talked a lot about cyber warfare in the past and cyber threats to America. America is one of the most technologically reliant militaries in the world. From your perspective, is this a strength or is this a weakness?
Well, I think that as long as nobody attacks it, it's a great strength, but we're so vulnerable with our dependence on cyber technologies that overall it is a great weakness. And we've even seen the Navy recently has figured out a way to do navigation based on the stars again, just sort of preparing for a time when they may not have all those technologies to rely on. And we've seen other countries go back to using typewriters for their official documents. Germany did that recently, just because they know that everything on computers can be targeted by these Chinese and Russian hackers. So it's interesting.
Good.
Oh, they're incredibly good. Yeah, incredibly successful. This Atlantic piece ends with a really interesting sentence, I think. It says, it's a brave new war without beginning or end, where the borders of peace and war, serviceman and civilian, have become utterly blurred, and where you and I are both a target and a weapon.
Thank you, Jeremiah. In case you're just joining us, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review on 101.3 on the FM dial or on kpcg.fm. I'm Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker today. We've just finished discussing Iran's recent actions to develop ICBMs and how the West is woefully unprepared for this new hybridized warfare that's being practiced by China and Russia. Now let's go ahead and turn our attention to Anglo-America, and for that, I'd like to introduce Anthony Chibarwe. Anthony, what is going on in America this week?
Well, this week and this year, we've had some staggering records, and some of the news items that we have in the Trumpet Weekly this week have something to do with some of those records from 2015. And one of them says, 2015 was a record year for federal regulation. It says the daily publication of the federal government's rules, proposed rules, and notices in 2015 amounted to 81,611 pages as of Wednesday. And that's higher than last year's by about 10,000 pages.
So that's the new things from this year. Not
yes.
Total, that's new.
That's new from this year. And yeah, that's just big government. So watch out for that big government and big government regulation. And speaking of regulation, there's an article also in the Trumpet Weekly about President Obama's executive action to issue work permits to a huge number of foreign workers above and beyond the levels that have been set by Congress. The rules will just make each of the foreign graduate students a lot cheaper than U.S.-born students. Another article, according to the S&P, the United States companies led the world in debt defaults in 2015. These are the stats. As of last week, 111 companies worldwide had defaulted on their obligation. And that's a record since 2009. And of those 111 companies, 60% of those global defaults of 2015 were United States companies. So United States leading the way in the bad way. One last item that I have, it's about three secrets to happiness. And this is according to a study by a Harvard psychiatrist. And he had the three secrets: good relationships, quality, not necessarily quantity, of relationships, and stable, supportive marriages. So basically the conclusion is, if you want to be happier and healthier, develop good relationships.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. And what was the big story out of the English-speaking world today?
Well, the big story that I have this week is not as much news as it is history. And if I could add right off the bat, it's also a lot of prophecy in the story. 16 years ago yesterday, the United States made history and prophecy. It gave up the Panama Canal. Now, the United States gave up this really strategic waterway that has greatly contributed to the wealth and the success of the United States. And yes, 16 years ago, we gave it up. I thought it's important for us to just bring this subject onto the radio program, because yes, it happened 16 years ago, but it is important. It is really significant. It is really important because, like I said, it's one of those many blessings that have helped make the United States what it is right now, and we don't have it anymore. And it's just a trend of things that we have been watching for and things that we expect to watch for.
You said this was prophetically relevant. Would you just let our readers know what you're talking about?
Okay. Maybe just I'll start off just with a little bit of history about the canal itself. There have been a lot of people who have been trying to build such a canal, especially with the growth of international trade. The Holy Roman Empire around the time of Charles V, they wanted to promote that. They wanted to build something that will just cut the transit times, with trade and all. And in around 1534, they were really making an effort to do this, but they sent out their surveyors to the canal, just to the area, and they came back to him and told him that this is going to be impossible to build something like what we have today.
So they failed.
They failed. And then the French came along, and they did quite a lot of work on it.
But they failed too.
They failed too. They spent a lot of money on it. They lost a lot of people trying to build it. But eventually the United States came along, and the United States was successful in building it. They didn't lose as many people. I think they lost about a quarter of how much the French lost during that period of building the canal. They started building, I think, in the early 1900s, and they completed the project in 1914, and it was considered one of the, and it still is considered one of the seven wonders of the modern world.
One of the most strategic pieces of real estate in the world. Cuts transit times from going around South America. Huge piece of infrastructure that any nation would be a benefit to own. But here we are, we've given this up, we've lost this. And as you said, this is prophetically important, isn't it? This is something that the Bible talks about, losing these transit routes.
Yes, certainly. The Bible, you gave a radio program a couple of days ago about the United States, about its geography and how God used geography to bless this nation. And it goes back to the Bible in Genesis 22, where God promised that he would give these sea gates to the United States. He said he would give these sea gates to the descendants of Abraham, which primarily is the United States and Britain. And he gave those, and Panama is one of those. The Panama Canal is one of those, and they've been such a strategic benefit to the United States. But then God also prophesied that if those nations are not obeying his law, is going to take them away. And that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing the United States giving it away. We have our booklet by Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, who talked about some of these prophecies. Based on these prophecies, he predicted that the United States was going to lose the Panama Canal long before 1999. He predicted that based on what the Bible says. And now we're seeing it happening. And 16 years on, we're seeing how it has been affecting the United States and how it will affect the United States.
If people want to learn more about this, maybe you can go ahead and tell them what book to write in for.
Yes, it's a book that's titled He Was Right. He Was Right. You can find it on our Trumpet website. It's just a powerful booklet about all the prophecies that God has and that we have been talking about for decades and that we have been seeing fulfilled over time.
And if people want proof that the United States today really does come from the descendants of Abraham, they can go online to thetrumpet.com and look for The United States and Britain in Prophecy, another book written by Herbert W. Armstrong, and that will give you the proof on that. Okay, Anthony, thank you very much. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription of our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories are in there. And now we'll go ahead and finish this program with our lightning round of important news from our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the week in review. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. Brent, take it away.
Okay, so there's a powerful story in the Wall Street Journal this week that exposed some of the Obama administration's inner dealings and how they spied on their allies. Now, we remember that there was revelations that came out in 2013 by NSA contractor Edward Snowden. He talked about how the United States was on purpose spying on people such as Angela Merkel, French President François Hollande, basically everybody, to see what they were doing behind what business they were doing that wasn't out in the open. Now, for people to spy on other countries, they still do it. They always do it. It's not a big deal necessarily. While they talk about how horrible it is on the surface, everyone does it. But at that time, there was a certain couple of people that were taken off the watch list. Angela Merkel was taken off the watch list. They said, President Obama said, we will not have surveillance on you. And that was done. French president as well. And other NATO leaders of countries, they were not watched. But there was one country that he said posed a significant security for significant security reasons that were going to hurt the United States, that we're going to keep on that list. And that was none other than Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He was aware that Netanyahu knew about what was going with the nuke talks, and he was scared that Netanyahu was going to come out and tell the world what was happening between Iran and the United States. So he wanted to get one step on Netanyahu, and they kept on surveilling him.
Thank you, Brent. Jeremiah, lightning round.
Officials across Russia have been given a book of prophetic quotes by President Vladimir Putin as a New Year gift. This book is called Words That Changed the World. It was sent to as many as 1,000 high-level Russian officials, along with a letter saying that the book should be seen as a guide to the Kremlin's values and principles. And this book is now considered required reading for any Russian politician. This is interesting because of the historic precedent of authoritarian rulers writing their ideologies in books and then requiring their subordinates to carry the books around and study them constantly. It happened with Chairman Mao during China's Cultural Revolution. His little red book became, you know, mandatory reading. His ideologies ended up killing more than 50 million people. It happened with Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, very famous book that we look back on and say, why didn't we believe what Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf years before he carried out those diabolical plans? He said what he was going to do. And then more recently, Muammar Gaddafi had his Green Book, which set out all of the Libyan dictators' political philosophies, and it was required reading for all Libyans. So now that a book of Putin's memorable quotes is being circulated in Russia, it just seems like a chilling echo of what some autocrats have done in the past, this kind of high-level indoctrination campaign, and it's sobering to think about what the implications of this might be.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Anthony, lightning round.
Okay, another record. For the first time in more than a decade, all categories of crime rose across Los Angeles in 2015. Violent crime in LA climbed 19.9%, and property crime increased 10.3%. And this is coming after about a time when the records have been declining, and now they are just shooting up. Something is not right in LA.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Okay, Richard, lightning round.
Elementary school children are looking for help in changing their gender. That is an article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly this week. It's from a charity that is trying to help these children do this, and it has some absolutely shocking pieces of information. There are children as young as 4 who are being helped to change their gender. And then one of the things that really stood out to me is that they're starting to see this clustering effect, where at one school there'll be a boy who wants to be a girl, and once he starts going through this process, then a whole bunch of other students of the same age, again, we're talking 5, 6, 7-year-olds, will come out and say, oh, well, actually, I want to do the same thing as well. And so you're getting it spreads into with their friends. And the charity that put a lot of this information across is talking about this, about as if it's just this great thing for Britain's young people. But I look how young the children we're talking about in this article are. And you know, you could see a child if they're maybe 5 years old and their friend is transitioning genders. I mean, they have no idea what that means, what that involves. All they see is their friend getting a whole lot of attention. And so they may well just try and copy. And kids copy each other anyway. That's exactly what anybody who has kids sees all the time. And so to have this being hailed as a good thing and a great step forward for Britain's schools is just very sad.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Again, I'm today's Trumpet Hour host, Robert Morley. I'm filling in for Joel Hilliker, and we are coming to the end of our program. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories are in there, as well as links to our Trumpet articles and more explanation. Send us your thoughts, questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter at thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Anthony Chibarway.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you all with a quote from Zig Ziglar. He says, "Honesty and integrity are absolutely essential for success in life, all areas of life. The really good news is that anyone can develop both honesty and integrity." Thank you all for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.